Malcolm Gladwell wrote a book called David and Goliath. Only the very first part of it actually is about David and Goliath. He has some good stuff in it. It's not a very good book. I reviewed it for Tablet. It's not one of his more successful forays into... But anyway, so... But he, among the, there was an article in the LA Times this morning because he posits that, not based on his work, but he quotes other people that Goliath had some kind of medical condition, but it's a much too literal reading of the story to assume you can diagnose somebody from the story in the Torah, any more than we can diagnose Saul, even though we have much more information about Saul and Goliath. But you realize that that's how Gladwell writes his books. He extrapolates from scholarship and tries to find things about human nature, and he tells a great story. He's a wonderful storyteller. So even though it's not such a great book, it's fun to read. But I wouldn't recommend it for tremendous insights. I mean, one of the problems is that the stories don't seem to make the same point. They make contradictory points. One story is about the three strikes law. Anyway, if you want to know what I think about it, you can look up the review. It's in Tablet, or you can just Google Walpy Gladwell. It'll probably come up. Or you can not read it, which is what I would recommend. There are a lot of good books out there. And remember, every book you read, you're neglecting other books. So if you start to read a book and you don't like it, don't feel bad about putting it aside, because it's actually not that you're slighting that book. It's that you're slighting all the better books that you could be reading while you're reading that one. And if you put it aside, then you'll have time to read the other ones. So as I get older, I'm much more willing to discard books. And I'm in the middle of a very, very long book, and I'm glad I'm reading it. I'm glad I have the time to read it, because I'm not reading something that's shorter that's stupid. It's called, by the way, if you're interested, it's called The Luminaries. It just won the Booker Prize in England, and it's brilliantly written. It reads like a Victorian novel. It's not a simple book to read, but it's very impressive, especially because she's 28 years old. She's the youngest winner ever of the Booker Prize, which means she wrote this in her mid-20s, which I find astonishing, really gifted. Although Dickens wrote the Pickwick Papers when he was in his mid-20s, but he was Dickens. We've completed the first chapter of the second book of Samuel, and if you recall, we talked about the fact that David had his lament for Saul and Jonathan. We talked about what his relationship was, which again we can't know, but there are at least pointers that his loss of Jonathan was for him a great personal loss. And the reason that that's worth remembering is that those kinds of losses are worth keeping in mind, because they tend to color future actions and behavior of someone's life. And although David, thus far, Saul and Jonathan, who are sort of David's substitute family, are the people that he's been described as close to. We really don't know that he was close to his brothers. We don't know that he was close to his parents. There's no description of that, really. In fact, it implies the opposite. The only thing we have with his father was his father forgot to introduce him. The only thing we have with his brothers is that they were upset when he was on the field with Goliath. The only people that we know he interacted with were Saul's family, that is Michal, Saul's daughter, Jonathan, Saul's son, and Saul himself, and now they're gone. So, and it happened afterward, chapter 2, that David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up into one of the towns of Judah?" Now, what does that mean, that David inquired of the Lord? I want to answer the question on two levels. The first is, what does it mean theologically? Did David really ask God something and God answered? And here, it's not possible to give an answer that's a definitive answer. I mean, you have to decide what you believe. Is there a God who speaks to David? Is there a God? And if so, is that God the kind of God who speaks to David? Well, in the ancient world, obviously David thought so. And that's how the Bible depicts it, just like with the prophets. But what that means, you're going to have to decide for yourself. What it means in terms of the reality of the way David asks of God is not that David looks up at the heavens and says, should I go to Judah? And God says, yes. That isn't how it works. The way it works is David inquires probably of the Urim and Tumim, which are these, it's based on the breastplate of the high priest, but they're also, they're almost like dice. They're these figurines that they throw and they give you a yes or no. You have to ask a binary question. You can't say, you know, what will my future hold? It's not a Ouija board. You have to say, shall I go up or shall I not go up? And then the priest gives you the answer, and you believe it's from God if you think it's an honest and good priest or so on. So when it says that Saul couldn't get an answer from God, what does that mean? It probably means that no priest could give him an answer that they felt confident in or something like that. But that may also, it may also mean because the priest read Saul's demise, and so they didn't want to be the priest of the man who was not going to be king for very much longer. But that's what it means when David inquires of the Lord, right? It's not like as depicted in the Torah, where Moses speaks panim el panim, face to face, right? Later on, it's through the Urim and Tumim, and he said, should I go up to one of the towns of Judah? Remember, at this point, David is the captain of a roving group of bandits. That's all he is, right? I mean, maybe he's been proclaimed king, but that doesn't mean that everybody else is calling him king. All we know is that he's been hiding out in the Philistine lands and that he's been attacking cities and bringing the loot to the king and also to his men. And now he returns to Judah because Saul is dead, and he says, should I go up into one of the towns? And God says, yes. So, where shall I go up? And presumably he gives different towns, and he says to Hebron. This, by the way, again, for those of you, wherever you are on the political spectrum, you should be aware of the fact that even though Hebron may never be a Jewish city, that it is next to Jerusalem the most historically Jewishly saturated city in the land of Israel. I mean, that doesn't mean that it's going to be a Jewish city in a state of Israel, but Hebron next to Jerusalem, there's no place that has more Jewish history from Abraham on than Hebron, except Brooklyn. And David went up there, and his two wives as well, Ahinoam the Jezreelite, and Abigail, the wife of Nabal the Carmelite. And his men who were with him, David brought up, each man and his household, and they settled in Hebron. And the men of Judah came and anointed David there as king over the house of Judah. So he's getting anointed again, right? This has happened before, but now he's getting anointed by the people, in quotes, not just by Samuel, and he's getting anointed in Hebron, which makes Hebron, and I believe it will be this way for about 8 years after, it makes Hebron the first capital of David. We always think of Jerusalem as the city of David, but it started with Hebron. And they told David, saying, they is the ubiquitous they, you know, people who move information from one place in a society to the other. It's like David, it's the equivalent of David received a phone call, saying it was the men of Yavesh Gilad who buried Saul. if you remember, the Philistines had put him up on a spike, and the men of Yavesh Gilad carried out this daring midnight raid to recover his body and give it a proper Jewish burial. And David sent messengers to the men of Yavesh Gilad and said to them, blessed are you to the Lord that you've done this kindness with your Lord, with Saul, and have buried him. And now may the Lord show faithful kindness to you, and I on my part as well shall do this bounty for you because you've done this thing. And now may your hands be strengthened and be you men of valor, for your Lord Saul is dead, and it is I who am the house of Judah has anointed as king over them. Now, you gather from the speech something that the narrator didn't say, which is David says, shall do this bounty for you because you have done this thing, which probably means that the messengers carried something to the people of Yavesh Gilad as a reward for having done this for Saul. And why does David do this? here again, as in innumerable times in the story. You can see it as a kindness or as a power maneuver. That is, the men of Yavesh Gilad rescued Saul's body because they're loyal to the house of Saul. That's what they care about. They care about Saul and Saul's legacy, so they helped him. So David knows that he needs to win over the Saul loyalists in order to be king. The way you do that is by saying, thank you, and here are gifts. Because remember, now that I'm king, I can give you gifts and will give you gifts. And I'm grateful that you did this for Saul. And look at his last line. He says, and it is I whom the house of Judah has anointed king. So, but just know, Saul is in fact dead. You did bury him, and I'm king now. That's the Machiavellian way of looking at it. The kind way of looking at it is that David was moved by this kindness that they did for his predecessor Saul, and so he wants to thank them. And I don't think that it has to be either one or the other. It's not necessarily, they're not mutually exclusive. Sometimes we do things that are nice that are actually also to our benefit. So David probably thinks, I have nothing to lose by thanking them and giving them gifts and reminding them that now that Saul's dead, by the way, I'm king and not Saul's son, whom we will run across later, Ish-bosheth. He is not king, I am. So, and here, and I prove it, because what power does a king have? A king can lavish gifts on people, right? Make cabinet appointments. And Abner, son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, had taken Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, and brought him to Machanaim and made him king over Gilad and over the Asherite and over the Jezreel and over Ephraim and over Benjamin and over Israel altogether. So now we know that David faces opposition. That in the north, David, remember, is in Judah in the south, but in the north, which is Saul's traditional power base, Saul's son, Ish-bosheth, has taken over. And he has a commander of his troops, Abner, who will play a part later on too. So this means that all of Israel didn't all of a sudden proclaim David as king. And the sense that we, I mean, the history, especially if you look at what hints are left in the Torah, it's always messier than memory. You know, we think, okay, Saul died, David became king, and the Davidic dynasty lasted forever, but it's not true. And it reminds you also that people are much more impressive generally in retrospect than they are if you actually know them. That is, we can't imagine, how could anybody have met Lincoln and not have thought that he was a great man? But a lot of people met Lincoln and didn't think he was a great man, you know, especially if they were Southerners. Really, I remember, I don't know if you ever saw Ken Burns' Civil War show, which was amazing television, amazing, amazing television, maybe the best I've ever seen. And he has this 8 or 10 part series on the Civil War, and one of the people that he interviews, I think, is the descendant of, it might have been Stonewall Jackson, I don't remember, but she's this one of the southern generals, and the interviewer says to her, you know, a lot of people say that really the only two great men that the Civil War ever produced, the only two truly great men, were your great-great-grandfather and Abraham Lincoln. And she goes, well, we don't think so much of Mr. Lincoln around here. I mean, and this is, you know, in the 1990s. So so here with David, it's not as though David swept all before him. There were people who saw David and knew David and decided that Ish-bosheth was their king, and because he was Saul's descendant and they didn't trust him. 40 years old was Ish-bosheth when he became king over Israel, and 2 years did he reign. But the house of Judah followed David, and the span of time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. So David was king in Hebron for about 7.5 years before he goes to Jerusalem. And we're about to find out what happened with Ish-bosheth in a minute. But Ish-bosheth was adult. He waited 40 years, right, for his father to die before he could become king, and he now has become king. Because, you know, even though lifespan in the ancient medieval world was young, if you made it past your 20s, then there was a good chance you'd make it to around 60. I mean, it's true that average lifespan was probably 20, I don't know exactly, but that's because there was so much infant and early mortality. But if you became a healthy adult, then the chances were that you would live a reasonable life. So 40 is not very old. I mean, remember that the Psalms say that the average, that the full life is 70. So you don't say that if nobody's living to 70. You say that if a normal, good, long lifespan is 70, the way that we would think today in what? Mid-80s, 90, we would say that person lived a good, long life, right? Okay, what's that? Oh. All right, so Avner, son of Ner, he's the commander for Ish-bosheth. Avner, son of Ner, and the servants of Ish-bosheth, remember, the son of Saul. And by the way, his name was probably Ish-baal. That was probably his name, because Boshet means shame. Nobody calls themselves man of shame, Ish-bosheth, right? But that was probably the name that the narrator gave him because he's David's narrator, so he calls him Ish-bosheth. Ish-baal was probably his name, and if you ask, wasn't Baal a Canaanite god, the answer is yes. But after all, you have all sorts of Jews who are named for, you know, for various things that they're either aware of or not aware of. People name their kids after everything from astrological symbols to cosmetics. You have no, I mean, every people use, right, it's true. People use every name they like, and it's common in the society for their kids' names. And so it wasn't, I guess, was not uncommon for someone to be called Ish-baal. I mean, you even look at the rabbis in the Talmud. There's a Rabbi Alexander and a Rabbi Aristobulus, all these Greek names, right? There's a Rabbi Ishmael, a very famous Rabbi Ishmael, and yet there's no Rabbi Moses. So names are peculiar that way. All right. He sallied forth from Machanaim to Givon, and David and Joab, remember, is David's commander, son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David sallied forth, and they met each other by the pool of Givon, and they took up their positions on either side of the pool. Now, this is what ancient warfare is like. This is an amazing glimpse of what warfare is like. And Abner said to Joab, pray let the lads arise and litzachek before us. And the reason I say litzachek is because, obviously, you know the word from Yitzchak, which means laughter, but it says that that Esau used to litzachek, and the rabbis say that what that means is that he used to shoot arrows at people. And I remember when I first saw that interpretation, I thought that's so arbitrary. They just don't like him. But then I realized that it comes from here. They're just generalizing from this. So litzachek, to play, can have positive or negative meanings, as it can, by the way, in English. When you say to somebody you're playing games, it's not a positive thing. It's usually a negative thing, even though that doesn't mean, obviously, that they're about to stab you, and that's what it means here. And Joab said, let them arise, and they arose and crossed over, 12 in number for Benjamin and for Ish-bosheth, son of Saul, and 12 from servants of David. And each man grasped the head of the other with the sword at his side, and the other, and they fell together. They killed each other, basically. Yes. So, and the commanders watched, and that's how they fought. And they called that place the Field of Flints, which is in Givon, and the fighting was very fierce on that day. With Abner, the men of Israel were routed by the servants of David. So it wasn't just those 12, but obviously it was some form of ritualized combat where you didn't expect to be killed. You expected to be able to kill the other guy, but the other guy was skillful too, and they ended up killing each other. And the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab and Abishai and Asahel. These three were all, Joab, remember, is David's commander. The other two, Abishai is the one who, so we know something about Joab. Joab is his commander. Joab is the one who made sure that Uriah, is killed. He's the one that does the dirty work for David when David wants to kill Bathsheba's husband. We'll come to that in a little bit. Abishai, we know, although you may not remember him, because he's the one who wanted to kill Saul instead of just cut off his cloak. Abishai said, oh my God, there's Saul, let me go kill him. And David has to restrain him and say, no, I'm not going to kill Saul. I'm just going to let him know that I could have killed him, so maybe he'll leave me alone. So we already know that there is like too much testosterone among the sons of Zeruiah, right? We know Yoav is like that and Avishai is like that. They're bloodthirsty men, right? They're warriors. And you need such men, obviously, today and then, because if you're going to have an army, then you have to have people who love fighting, because people who love fighting will fight differently from people who hate fighting. So you need people who love fighting, and that's who Yoav and Avishai are. What we don't know is what Asahel is, but we're about to find out. And Asahel was as swift-footed as one of the gazelles of the open field. And Asahel chased after Abner. Remember, Abner is the commander of Ish-bosheth's forces, so he's got to be a pretty formidable fighter himself. And Asahel is now running after him to kill him because he figures if he kills the commander of Ish-bosheth's forces, then David has a tremendous advantage in the war. And he swerved not to the right nor to the left of going after Abner. And Abner turned around and said, "Are you Asahel?" And he said, "I am." And Abner said to him, "Swerve to your right or to your left and seize for yourself one of the lads and take you his tunic." In other words, go kill one of the soldiers. Don't come after me. Right? Now, how they said that to each other when they were both running, I don't know. But maybe they stopped for a moment, had a little talk, and then ran again. I can't tell you. It's very hard to know. But Asahel didn't want to turn away from him. And Abner once more said to Asahel, "Turn you away from me. Why should I strike you to the ground? And how would I show my face to Yoav, your brother? I don't want to kill you. Yoav and I, we're both commanders. We understand each other. We have mutual respect. How am I going to face him if I kill his brother? So don't run after me." And he refused to turn aside, and Abner struck him in the belly with the butt of his spear, and the spear came out behind him, and he fell there and died on the spot. So you can imagine that Abner is running, and he's running behind him, and Abner gauges when he's close enough behind him, and he thrusts his spear behind him and kills him. So he didn't want to kill him, and he really had no choice. Asahel left him no choice, okay? And this, again, this is very characteristic of the family. That is, they're warriors, and they love to fight, and Asahel saw this opportunity. Maybe he saw an opportunity, since he was the youngest, to be considered, you know, he's the one who killed Abner. Whatever the reason, it cost him his life. I remember in one of Saul Bellow's novels, I don't remember which one, he uses this as an image for somebody whose life is going too quickly, and he says, like Asahel, he ran too fast. You know, which is a great use of it. And he refused to turn aside, and Abner struck him in the belly, and he died on the spot. And it happened that whoever came to the place where Asahel fell and died stood still. In other words, all these soldiers came, and they saw Asahel, and they gathered around there. There was a crowd. So it was drawing attention because there was a crowd standing around Asahel. And Yoav and Avishai chased after Abner. Now his brothers want to kill Abner because he killed their brother. Yeah, maybe it wasn't his fault, but they don't, A, know that, or B, if they do, they don't care. I mean, you killed my brother. What do I care if it was? And as the sun was setting, they come to the hill of Ammah, which faces Giah on the way to the wilderness of Givon. And the Benjaminites gathered behind Abner and formed a single band, and they took stance at the top of a certain hill. So you have to imagine this. Abner's standing there. He's the commander, and he's got all of his fighters behind him. And Yoav and Avishai want to kill him. And this is what he says. And Abner called out to Yoav and said, "Must the sword devour forever?" Very powerful line. "You surely know that it will be bitterness in the end. And how long will you not say to the troops to turn back from their brothers?" Right. He also refers to themselves as brothers. It's actually a very beautiful and powerful speech, and has been quoted many, many times in modern Israel too, that phrase, "must the sword devour forever," a common phrase. And Yoav says, "As God lives, had you but spoken from this morning, the troops would have given up pursuit of their brothers." In other words, if you'd said this before, we could have avoided a lot of bloodshed, putting it on him. Whether it was on him or not, whether he started it or not, I don't know, but that's how Yoav frames it. And Yoav sounded the ram's horn, and all the troops halted, and they no longer chased after Israel, and they fought no more. So that was it. That was the end of the battle, at least for now. Now remember, there's an underlying problem, right? You know, even if you get the website to work, the question is, will the healthcare system be effective? There's still an underlying question here, and the underlying question is, who's going to be king? even if they get them to stop fighting, sooner or later, it's got to be Ishbosheth and David, and it's not going to work for someone like David. It's not going to work to have a king in the north and for him to just be king in the south. You know, later on in Jewish history, the north and south split, and they had separate kings, and there was always antagonism. But especially for David, he wants to be king over all, and he's not going to leave Ishbosheth and the house of Saul, who many people see as the legitimate king. He's just, he can't leave them in place. And his men went all that night through the Arava, which is through the sort of desert lands, and they crossed the Jordan and went all the way through the ravine and came to Mahanaim. And Yoav turned back from pursuing Abner, and he gathered all the troops, and 19 of David's servants were missing, and Asahel. In other words, 19 had died, and Asahel the 20th. And David's servants struck down from Benjamin and from Abner's men 360 men. Are these accurate numbers? I don't know. But it's a way of saying David won the battle decisively. And they bore away Asahel and buried him in his father's grave, which is in Bethlehem. And Yoav and his men went all night long, and the day brightened for them in Hebron. In other words, they walked all night, and when dawn came, they came to the city of Hebron, which, as we know now, is David's capital and his stronghold and where they are. Okay, so let me just make one or two more observations, and then we'll open it up for discussion. So, first of all, the combat, presumably, that Abner and Yoav had, presumably that combat is to attempt to win the battle without killing too many people. I mean, it sounds to us ridiculous to have that kind of ritualized fighting, but if you have several rituals like that and one side wins, then maybe the convention is that you understand that they're stronger, they're gonna win the battle, so the other side gives up without having to have a full-on battle where everybody's gonna die. David doesn't want to invade the towns in northern Israel. First of all, because he doesn't want to slaughter innocent civilians, and second, because he doesn't want them to hate him, right? He wants to be their king. He doesn't want to be their enemy. So if you can show in a series of stylized battles that your army is clearly stronger, the other, in theory, should give up. Remember, that was the idea, even though it didn't turn out that way, behind David and Goliath, which was Goliath said, instead of engaging a full-scale battle and everybody dying, pick somebody to fight me, and whoever wins will be the other one's slaves, even though David won and there was no, you know, then the Philistines reneged on the deal, so to speak. But so it does make sense in a way, although again, it's not going to be the end. This one battle is not going to be the end of the rebellion or the division. Something else will end it. It's upended, as so many things are in the Bible and perhaps in life, by a dispute over a woman, as you will see. That's what actually ends up dooming Ishbosheth and Abner. But the other part of this is that it shows the even more than today how intricately mixed is the personal and the political. Because Abner is going to end up being killed by Yoav. I don't think this is any great surprise to you. In the end, Yoav is going to kill Abner, and he's going to kill him for lots of reasons, but mainly because he killed his brother. And the people who, you know, I mean, one of the things that we have to constantly readjust in our minds is the scale. It's like you would not expect to know the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. You wouldn't expect to. Maybe life would bring you in contact with them, but you wouldn't expect to. But everyone knows Yoav, because we're talking about, you know, I mean, there was this huge battle, 20 people died on one side and 300-some died on the other. It's like in all of Hebron, there were probably fewer people than belonged to Sinai Temple. We're talking about a small, really, and it's possible, I suppose, to know all of Sinai Temple. I don't, but it's possible. But we're talking about very small numbers, and a couple of battles with a couple of hundred people can be decisive for who's going to be the king of Israel. We just don't think of it that way, but the numbers are tiny. The first city that had 1 million people was Rome, and after Rome fell, no city on earth had 1 million people until London did in the 19th century. Now that's a long time for no city to have 1 million people. But in the ancient world, it was the same thing. A city was, you know, a big city was a few thousand people. So that's a lot. I know it's a ridiculously random fact. I don't know where I found that one, but check it out. It's true. Somehow it stuck to my head. Okay. So questions, comments? Yes.
I thought if we know our history, we're not going to repeat it.
Great comment. Yes.
Right. But also, so what do we learn from this other than an intellectual exercise?
So let me quote to you what A.J.P. Taylor, who was a famous English historian, said about Napoleon III. He said he studied history in order to avoid the mistakes of the past and to make new ones. So, right. So yeah, we make new ones. I mean, well, the problem is that human nature overrides human experience, because it doesn't matter. I mean, think of it in terms of personal life too. Do we learn from our own past? Sometimes yes, but more often no. I mean, that's why Freud talks about a repetition compulsion, right? In fact, you have a compulsion to repeat your past to make it come out different, even though it doesn't. So it's very, very hard. And also, the past teaches different lessons. So what do you learn? Do you learn the lesson of Vietnam or of World War II? That was the big debate when we were going to go into Iraq. Right, well, that's what I'm saying, is you don't know which lesson to pick. Do you pick the lesson of David, as in it's divisive and it's bloodthirsty, or you could pick the lesson of David as in he gets to be the king of Israel forever after. So I don't know which lesson you pick. It's very hard to decide what history unambiguously teaches and then to apply that lesson unambiguously to now. How do you do that? So you hear, for example, people now, I made a joke about Obamacare before, but so you hear people now talking about how the government takeover of people's lives is never successful on the one side. Look at all these. And then on the other side, people say, but what about Social Security that is successful? And so people will argue whether Social Security is successful. And if you're the proverbial Martian, yeah, they both have argument. I mean, neither argument is on the face of it ridiculous. They both have, in the context of their own ideological structure, they both make sense. One is going to be right and one is going to be wrong, but it's not as though one is completely contrary to all fact and logic and the other one is perfect. So it's hard. By the way, let me just, I brought this down. I want to make this announcement, don't want to forget. Not implying that any of you are senior citizens, but if you are, Sci-Hi, which is our 8th to 12th grade teen program, is looking to partner with 3 to 5 senior citizens in an intergenerational, fun, and supportive Jewish improv class. They want high schoolers and senior citizens to improv together, which is a great idea. It's 2 Sundays a month on the following dates, and it gives you all the dates, and then you give a performance on May 4th. So if you are interested, I'm going to leave the flyer up here. And if you are interested or you know someone who's a senior citizen that loves to perform and loves teenagers, it's a great thing to do. And so I promised I would announce it. Miriam.
Yes.
And you go back and you say, well, how come this is for the show? And how come this is for the David? And you say, I wonder, did Samuel ever say to the people, God changed his mind?
Right.
He is from the new God. Don't support that guy anymore. I mean, it looks like it's either Samuel's fault or maybe God should have made people realize.
Right. So this is an interesting question. Why didn't Samuel unambiguously favor one and say, okay, Saul's out, David's in? Because we don't hear anywhere that he proclaims it to all of Israel. He goes up, he anoints David, and he tells Saul in front of Saul's people, God has taken the kingship away from you. He does do that. And remember, he rips his cloak. He turns away and Saul grabs onto to Samuel's cloak and the cloak rips. But he needed to do much more to change their loyalty. If he could even, so maybe it's a limitation of his power or maybe it's a limitation of his action. I don't know which, whether he could have done it. But here's what I would say. Everywhere where we can see beneath the theology of the Torah, human beings act like human beings. And it's very rare for God to come and say something. In fact, I told you that I think it was Jack Miles who had this great line. He says, God can command everything except the people's enthusiasm. You know, it's like God can tell you David's going to be king now, but the people who believe in Saul believe in Saul. And so it's, I think it would have been very hard, if not impossible, to get the northerners to who clearly didn't like David and thought that David had something to do with the downfall of fall of Saul. They probably think, yeah, David says that God wants him. Samuel says that God wants him, but we know better.
Yeah. I wonder if we could go back to verse 21, where it says, "And Abner said to him, swear to your right or your left, right, and seize for yourself one of the lads." What's the Hebrew word that lads come from? Lads is a peculiar word in my mind.
I assume it's na'ar. Anybody have the Hebrew here? Yeah. Verse 21. Na'ar. Na'ar. Yeah. Na'ar. One of the lads. It means lads. Yep.
As we understand it.
One of the boys, one of the teenagers. I mean, they were probably, what, 13, 14, 15 years old, I'm guessing. Those were the soldiers. So, take one of the lads. Yeah.
It seems like the division between Judah and Israel is already existing here. Could you give some background?
As far as we know, it never didn't exist. That is, Saul was from the north, but it was clear that the northerners were, you know, I mean, this is one of the many explanations, and this is a big topic that I'm not going to, that first of all, I don't know that much about, but also I wouldn't go into anyway. It's one of the reasons why people assume that Jesus' traditions were different, because he came from the north. Because northern traditions were different, the north was different, it was only united under Saul, David, and Solomon, and then it split apart again forever and ever. That's where the 10 tribes were, and the tribe of Judah seems to be. Now, why it is that they configure that way, that I don't know, and I don't know what it meant in terms of the settlement of the land. Remember, though, that what may have had some influence is that a lot of modern archaeologists believe that ancient Jews were ancient Canaanites who split apart and developed different traditions. And either they grew indigenously, or they were part of a group that also came from the outside, and that there was some kind of amalgam of the Jews who came, whether from Egypt, Haran, wherever they came from, and found a group there that they had either left behind, which is the way the Torah puts it, right? Jacob and his kids were there, and then they went to Egypt, and then they came back. So maybe there were people who remained there, and they found their kin. So there was a lot of mixing of possibilities, and there are a lot of reasons why they would have had different traditions along the way and been different groups. It's very interesting to speculate about the possibility that there were sort of proto-Jews. They weren't Jews yet, but like possible Jews still existing in Canaan who were separate population from the Canaanites, just which you can sort of get from the Torah, because did everyone go with Jacob or did some people stay behind? Everything we know about migrations through history is some people always stay behind, right? Just like when the Jews got to go back to Israel in the time of Babylonia, a lot of them stayed behind. When Cyrus rebuilt the temple, a lot of them stayed behind. When 1948 happened and people thought every Jew was going to go to Israel, they stayed behind. In good and bad places, they stayed behind. And therefore, whatever number left Egypt had people in Canaan that were already sympathetic with them, which would also, by the way, help explain how they could conquer Canaan if you had a group that was already there. So, anyway, yeah.
So, can you refresh my memory about, it says you only took two wives, what happened to Baal? Yeah. And second, I don't remember knowing about his son, only Jonathan, as Saul's son.
Yeah. Where there are a lot of Saul's, there were several, remember, several of Saul's sons die in battle. I don't remember how many, was it seven others die in battle? Four, is it? It's, 1 second, I'll tell you. But if you look at, three. Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua. Three of Saul's sons die in battle. We haven't heard of any of them. So, and just like we don't know what happened to Michal, she's going to pick up the story later, by the way. But Michal is apparently gone. We assume because Saul marries her off to Paltiel as a way of, which we know that he did, as a way of getting back at David. Remember, David ran away. Saul comes up to Michal and says, you know, why did you hide him? She says, David forced me to. He was going to kill me. That's the last time we see Michal and David together. And then Saul marries her off to another guy, who, according to the rabbi, she never had sex with, of course, because she was married to David. Just in case you were, you were worried about that, the rabbis have got you covered. But we'll see her again later, and it's not going to be a happy reunion. So, yeah. Right.
And David's troops, the good guys, only lost
20. Right.
And those numbers seem to be very similar to modern times when Israel has to go and fight against her enemies. And they always lose a small number as opposed to the enemy losing a big number.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any significance or any, I don't know, it's just a thought.
Well, the only thing I would say is we understand why that's true in modern warfare. I don't understand, and remember that both of these are Israel. These are Jews fighting against Jews. These aren't Jews fighting against non-Jewish enemies. So, to go back to Gladwell, with whom we started, part of that book is about the idea that what we think of as the underdog isn't always the underdog. And that is certainly the case, that sometimes, in fact, disadvantages, I mean, the pronounced theme of the book, but the book doesn't follow it, is that things that we think of as disadvantages are sometimes advantages, right? So there are stories, for example, in the book of people who, because they are dyslexic, develop skills that they would otherwise not have developed, and it enables them to run companies and do other, you know, and whatever. So I don't know why David succeeded. Were his troops better trained? Were they? I don't know. It doesn't say. It is certainly true that the story of the underdog killing more of the enemy is a popular trope in history. I don't know how to compare it to modern Israel, but it happens, I think, probably reasonably often. And my guess is that in most warfare, the numbers are vastly disproportionate. It's probably not usual that two nations fighting each other kill the same number of people. And it usually depends on technology, because technology can kill many, many more. I mean, the crossbow, once that developed, it changed warfare forever, because you didn't have to be close to the person that you killed. And Israel, obviously, vastly disproportionate technologically with the people around it. Right.
Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, wife
right.
of Nabal.
Right. Remember the story of Nabal?
I'm sorry, I don't.
Okay. The story of Nabal was that David and his band of people came to offer protection to Nabal, and he didn't want it, and Abigail came and gave what is the longest speech, actually, of any woman in the Torah. One second, I'll show you where it is. You can go back and take a look at it. I don't remember which chapter it is. Abigail, where are you? Abigail, 155 to 161. It is back in chapter, the first book of Samuel, in chapter 25. She goes and she pacifies David and says, don't kill my, he basically, the shepherds come back. David comes and says to Nabal, I'm David, I protected your shepherds, I made sure they weren't hurt by lions and tigers and bears, basically. And Nabal says, why should I bother about David? Who am I? I'm not giving him anything. So David says, okay, let's kill him and all of his household. Abigail comes out and says, don't do that. You don't want to be known as the person who goes around killing everyone. And she says, Kishmo Kenhu, my husband's name is Nabal, which means a boor, and he's just like his name. In other words, she doesn't like her husband either. So David says, okay, I won't do it. And Abigail goes back and tells Nabal the story, and miraculously he has either a stroke or a heart attack, probably a stroke, and he dies 8 days later, and she goes and marries David. And David, that was his first big haul. That is, David inherits Nabal's lands, and Nabal is a rich man. And it's the first thing that gives David, like every king, every ruler needs a financial base. You know, people talk about money in politics, that was always true. you always needed money to be a ruler, and that's what enables David to be a ruler. Now, this was, again, one of those instances where, why does Nabal die? It's a very convenient death. All I can say is, if you ever watched I, Claudius, that Roman women were very good at poisoning. That's all I'm going to say. I'm not saying that Abigail was. I'm just saying Roman women were. So who knows why Nabal died? Was it God? Was it Abigail? Was it David? Was it true coincidence, which is how the Torah presents it? But she does, and then David marries her. And she's one of the things, we'll see if it stays this way. It's off at readers now. But when I wrote the David book, the first part of it is not entirely chronological, because I have a whole chapter on David. I start off with David and women, basically, because it's amazing how repeatedly in the David story, women are the fulcrum on which everything turns. Again and again and again and again. I mean, Michal saves him from Saul, and Abigail saves him with Nabal, and obviously Bathsheba is extremely influential, and there'll be a woman of Tekoa that gets him to bring Avshalom back, and there's another woman that saves them from besieging a city, because she basically has the rebel killed and his head thrown over the wall, and they say, okay, that's all we needed, and they go home. It's just remarkable how much David's story is determined by the women in Israel. So, yeah.
Are the Benjaminites actually Benjamin's descendants?
The tribe of Benjamin. What?
No, I mean...
From here? There's no tell. I mean, they've been in Israel now through the period of the judges and the period of Samuel. I don't know how many generations it is, but they're part of the tribe of Benjamin. So people marry in, they marry out in different tribes. It's hard to say if they're all actually... Saul actually... Yeah, I mean, Saul's considered the descendant of Benjamin, but... And then the tribes all get lost when the northern kingdom is destroyed. So, yeah.
Yep. And I'm just struck by, you know, how different it all could be. It could be all the way to today, like Shiite and Sunni, and they never resolve the secession.
That's an interesting point. We didn't suffer that kind of division, first of all, because we didn't have political power. If we had political power, maybe we would have had that kind of division. Who knows? I mean, the reason that the 10 tribes... they were divided. The reason that 10 tribes didn't continue to be divided is because they were destroyed by the Assyrians. Yeah, so nothing unites you like an outside enemy. But that is an interesting thing to think about, that you don't have that division in Judaism, but if you had political power, you might have that division, and maybe it's developing today between the Orthodox and the secular, that kind of division. I don't know. Right.
Israel, so both of them became his wives.
Yep.
Saul had given his daughter Michal, David's wife, to Palti, son of Laish from Galim.
Right.
So did he undo the marriage and give her to somebody else?
Yeah, Saul did, yes. Did he undo the marriage? I don't know. Did he, as king, say, you're going to now marry him?
Yes.
Presumably. I mean, that's what we know. Kings could do, you know, basically what they wanted. They could do whatever they wanted unless they restricted themselves or someone else prevented them from doing it.
So people were not married under God. They were...
Who knows? I mean, in theory, it depends. If you look at the rabbis, how they retroject back, yes. But what marriage really meant then, especially if you were the daughter of a king and you were married to a rebel king and he decided, I want to give you to someone else, who was going to say no? Right. So unfortunately, women didn't have the power to say, no, I choose not to do that. Yeah.
Did Samuel have any supplanter?
Did?
Samuel.
What do you mean, did he have any supplanter?
Any priest took over his job?
Well, they didn't supplant would mean that they took over when he didn't want them to. After he died, other priests start running the temple. Well, it's not the temple yet, but start running the altars. We know, remember, that Saul kills all these priests of Nov, and David has a priest that comes with him, Abiathar. So yeah, there were always priests around. We don't know who the high priest was after Samuel. It doesn't mention here, but there are high priests later on in Jewish history, so presumably there was a line that continued through, because you needed, you know, the religious as well as the... There were really three centers of power in ancient Israel. There were the priests, there were the prophets, and there were the kings. So, and once the kings were done, there were just the priests and the prophets. And then those morphed in one way or another into the rabbis. The priest was... Samuel was sort of both, but the priests were the ones who ran the temple. Who chose them? Priests did. Priests chose priests. But they were also a hereditary line. They were the Kohanim, mm-hmm. right? What we think of as the Kohanim, they were the priests. So, last question. Yeah. Very hard to know. How do you know if somebody's actually a prophet or making it up? I think if they say what you like, then they are a prophet. But there are comments in the Torah about how do you tell a false prophet, but it's essentially, because that was a serious issue, it's essentially whether they preach against God's law, then they're false prophets. But how do you know if somebody's a real prophet in terms of what they say God wants and is going to happen? We know that in ancient Israel, Jeremiah was persecuted. We think of him as one of the greatest of the prophets, but his contemporaries thought of him as a lunatic. Because he was saying, you know, you're going to be destroyed. God's going to destroy the country. They hated him. They put him in chains and so on. And he turned out to be right. So it's probably the honest answer is you only know if somebody's a prophet later on. You don't know at the time whether they're right or wrong. There's no foolproof test. Do they accept what? What do you mean by do they accept prophets? Do modern biblical scholars think that God spoke to certain individuals? It depends on the biblical scholar, right? Seriously, it depends on the biblical scholar. Do they study the text as though this is the word of God? No, not in modern scholarship. They're trying to understand what the text means in its time. They do what's called bracketing. That is, if they're believers at all, they bracket their belief to say, what can we learn as modern scholars about this text? If you think, well, God dictated it all, then really there's nothing to learn about the development of the language and the other cultures around it and so on. But if you bracket all that, then that's how they study it. Okay, please rise.